Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Suzanne Preston-Blier, president of the College Art Association and one of the leading figures in the discipline of art history. She's the Alan Whitehill Close Professor of Fine Arts and African American Studies at Harvard University, and the author of numerous award-winning books and articles that are foundational in the field. Just to name a few, they include The Anatomy of Architecture, Ontology and Metaphor in Batamaliba Architectural Expression, African Vodun, Art, Psychology and Power, Ancient Yoruba, Ife, History, Power and Identity, and forthcoming, Picasso's Demoiselle, Africa, Sex, Origins and Creativity. Thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I wanted to start by asking you about this Africa Map project, which is an amazing digital information system. You can go online, look at the map and see all kinds of information. Could you just talk a little bit about what this means for people who are doing research in art history?
I'd be happy to. Let me give you a little bit of its history because it connects in important ways with the field itself. I was teaching at Columbia, so this dates me a little bit from the vantage point of technology when, of course, we were all using slides and scanning had just become possible. And I received an offer from Harvard and decided that it made sense. They had never had my field taught before, and got permission to scan the some 25,000 images in the Columbia slide collection. And Harvard looked at that and said, oh my goodness, this is an expensive hire, and invited me to apply for a fellowship. Some of these fellowships you have to be invited to apply for, and this was a foundation out of California that had funded a number of important projects, but they tended to be the sort of things that changed the world. And so I was competing with a number of scientists at Harvard and elsewhere, and the previous projects had been everything from how do we get American orchestra conductors? How do we stop jail recidivism? How do we find cures for cancer of this type or that type? It's not the kind of thing that necessarily an art historian, you know, how do I situate myself in that? And I knew that there had to be two goals within that. One is it had to be expensive. And two, it had to in some way change the world. And so I put together a project which is really apt for this series called Art and Creativity. And what I was looking at is the question of why is it that certain cultures at certain moments in time are associated with major artistic innovation. And clearly it's not DNA, or else the Greeks or the Egyptians, or pick any other key culture in history, would be in a very different place. And so I was looking at the kind of factors in place, and I came up with a theory about cultures coming together in various contexts that are engaged in some way with a kind of crisis. We can think about the Renaissance and the fall of Constantinople and an economic crisis in Italy and sort of the force coming together of people to really re-engage. We can talk about Paris, circa 1900, colonialism, the end of the Industrial Revolution and Picasso in Paris. We can talk New York, 1945, and the arrival of so many from the European intellectual community. And so I applied for this. Social Roots of Creativity was the title, and ended up getting the grant. And so our first project was the expensive part, which was to really map everything on Africa and to put it into a format that we could use broadly. The point was that it's not that Africa is without such information, it's just that it's never been brought together. And we used what was then a new system called GIS, Geographic Information Systems, which is now, as you know, the system behind so many of the things that we do. Then it was incredibly primitive and really hard. And so we did that for 7 or 8 years and got together a lot of great research. We were looking at the creativity of Islam, for example, in Africa and various other things. And I woke up, I think it was just about a decade ago, and the whole system was down. And at that point, we had so much data that it had to be carried on basically, you know, the equivalent of servers. And it had been housed in the museum in the library at Harvard, and they had looked at this and said, what is this? And That was that. So that same year, you know, it was about 10 years of work. There was a new fund for...
So all that was just gone?
Gone.
Oh, my gosh.
There was a small grant for innovative computing, and I applied for it and received the funding and tagged a faculty member who I'd known from faculty meetings to be both very smart and very tough and a great administrator, and he'd just been named the head of the Center for Geographic Analysis at Harvard. And he's a sinologist and an historian, and I said, I have this project. Do you want to co-chair it with me? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, he said, I know nothing about this. And I said, yeah, but you're the perfect person. So we worked together. He hired people. And we began with something called Africa Map, bringing together all the best maps, mapping data that you could use in creating your own mapping projects or doing any number of other things. And over time, we found that faculty across the university were using the same system in the Kennedy School, in sociology, in the School of Public Health, and other areas. And then we relaunched it as WorldMap. I mean, if you're dealing with Africa, you're really dealing with the world. What you're dealing with is lat longs and things you can put into play. And so we've moved forward with that. We received a NEH grant in digital humanities, and out of that, we were able to harvest every single map on any server in the world. And so you can bring that data into your map. It's a little bit like, to use a good analogy, WorldMap is a little bit like Wikipedia, but it has key differences. You can create your own maps in the system. When you upload mapping data, you can decide if you want to make it available to everybody. All of the software open source, right? And so we're working with other institutions in terms of creating some of the software itself. But you can upload any data and decide, do you want to have it only for yourself, for your team of scholars, or do you want to make it available for the world? And I would say 90% of the people say, let's make it available. And so right now you have some, I think it's 78,000 data layers that you can bring into your own map. And we've had over 2 million users, visitors from every place around the world. I use it regularly, just day to day in my research. I teach with it. I get my students doing it, using it. I've done maps on everything from all of Frank Lloyd Wright's houses, where they're located, to buildings, rather, to the Chicago World Fair. And any numbers, I teach a class on World's Fairs, to I've been recently using it to reimagine Africa with a critical east-west trade route. And we brought in data, just which is incredible. And for that, I've been using what was once CIA data, which has some 2 million data points, geographic and historic data points. And so to basically bring in where are all the wadis in Africa, for example. So it's fun, and I encourage you to use it. I one warning, it's addictive.
It is
enormously fun.
I can imagine. You alluded to some of these moments of extreme creativity, and I wanted to ask, I think in your book on art and risk in ancient Yoruba, these amazing artworks that from about 700 years ago associated, I think, with a particular court or royal kind of environment. I wondered if you could talk a little about the research methods that you used for that book and kind of how that all works in your, how you developed that
research. And that also, it's a nice lead-in with both the creativity and the risk of putting a system together like this that fails. I mean, this was, and thank goodness it did, because the WorldMap failed and we had to redo it. And of course, the technology was then so much stronger. Risk is great. And in the context of that book and its the research methods, there's not a single written source. And the archaeology at that point was grim. And so how does one begin to do it? This is one of the most important art corpuses anywhere in the world. And it had been discussed in various contexts, but largely in a descriptive way and an ahistorical way.
Right.
So I was intent from the outset on doing one particular thing and then seeing where it led me. And that was to marry whatever was there for the archaeological record and what was ever there from the vantage of oral historians, what they had captured about the history of the place, with whatever information I could find from the artworks themselves, and have these three partners really tell this story. And being driven by the artworks themselves, because they are the most concrete, they're really the only things we have from that period. The project began when I was a graduate student finishing my dissertation at Columbia, and I was working at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they had a great show there that the Detroit Art Institute had put together called Treasures of Ancient Nigeria. And I was walking through the galleries just as that was about to open, and I saw this pure copper mask, very naturalistic and stunning, just sitting there, bathed in that light, and I was sort of alone in the gallery. And I looked at the label, and it said Mask of Obalufon, or I think it was Obalufon II. And I said, wow, we have a name associated with a site that goes back to the 12th, 13th, 14th century. And I said, that is amazing. And I went on, I finished my dissertation, which was on architecture, and finished another book. And that still hung in my mind, because when I went into the field, we didn't have artist names and we didn't have dates for the most part. And so recuperating something of that history has been a real passion of mine, and recuperating whatever we can from history. So in my own work, I made a point to visit this area. Multiple short trips. I had a young daughter at the time. My first foray to Africa was in the Peace Corps. I left college at 19, and I didn't feel that art history was really going to make a difference in the world. And it was an important time. It was right after Bobby Kennedy's death. So I went to Africa, fell in love with Africa, and everything I was reading about African art was worse than the other. It was so pejorative. And so that was what I decided to dedicate my career to. So, and I was in a Yoruba town, and so learned Yoruba through that. So Ife is another Yoruba city, so I had a kind of familiarity. And I did a lot of work just going to the sites, visiting with and interviewing the families of early chieftaincies, and learning what I could on the ground from a sense of place, from a sense of these old sites, following up on... Up until 1950, most of these works were in situ. They were buried and then unearthed for particular ceremonies. Some have been found before then and after then through archaeological excavations, some of which were better than others. But it was a combination of those things and then trying to make sense of it. And from the risk vantage point, I wrote this incredibly long manuscript, half of which I've published here. It's a book of some 600 pages anyway, and sent it off to a publisher, the half part of it. And after a long time, she got back to me and she said, we're not going to publish it. She said, you need to have some more cohesive theme to it. And this is a great editor, and I've worked with her before. And I said, well, what are you reading in it that you see is happening? And she said, there's an awful lot of risk there. And then that struck me, because I've always was curious about, nowhere else in the world are people doing pure copper cast, life-size cast. It's almost impossible, because copper has such a very specific melting rate. It's softer. And there are many things about it that are just technologically incredibly difficult. Yeah. And some of the works are pure copper, and others are copper and alloys. Some of the works are bumped up with arsenic, like there's a death scepter where they've added extra arsenic to it. And I realized that at some point this civilization, so all the works are created within one generation, had decided that for whatever reason they needed to do the risks financially and in other ways to create these works. And part of it has to do with a brilliant art patron, this king, Obalufon II. Mm. And part of it has to do with his decision to honor the victors and the losers of a major civil war that had apparently gone on for 50 or 60 years, and which it was just devastating. It had been before then a major commercial site. They made their own glass beads that they were trading broadly throughout West Africa. And they controlled much of the key river crossing of the Niger River, so much of the trade that went east and west in Africa, and to some degree north and south. And so they had a lot of money. And I think probably at some point in the political hierarchy, there was a concern about what next king would be in power. And they invited an external group to come in to sort of make that decision. And then all hell broke loose.
Wow.
And so that was the basis for my framing of this work on the ground, actually going to the sites, really listening. We don't really talk in art history about listening, but really looking and listening closely to the artworks, and in the end have them as arbiters in terms of what kinds of decisions one is making.
Wow, amazing. You mentioned a moment ago being in the Peace Corps and making your first trips to Africa, and I wanted to ask about your book on the anatomy of architecture. Well, first of all, how you arrived at that topic, or how you decided to write a book on that?
That's also a really great question. So while I was in the Peace Corps, my parents came to visit, and which is a big honor, right? And so we took a trip. My brother and sister were with us, and we took a trip up to the north and passed through this country, this area that is on the Benin side of the Togo. It crosses the border with these amazing chateau-like two-story earthen houses. And I'm from Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And they, Vermonters, I mean, we all are defined by place in part, but celebrate their independence from New York, for example,
right,
going
right.
back to the to Ethan Allen, and the idea of independent farmers and having, I mean, definitely community, but having that kind of independence. And each of these was a kind of independent farm, and they're stunningly beautiful. And we went back, and when I left Peace Corps, I finished my undergraduate degree because I went back to University of Vermont and went to graduate school. In my first semester, my professor, Douglas Fraser, had just come back from Africa and was working on a film. And he wanted me to edit it, and it was on this area and on architecture, which I did poorly, I'm sure, but the name of it was Out of Fire Comes Strength, which is kind of my motto as well, you know, risk, thinking about the complexities and moving forward. And then it came time for a dissertation, and in those days, you had zero choice.
Oh.
So I came up and said, I'd love to work on Benin bronzes.
Yeah.
And he said, no, you're going to work on this architecture. And I come back and said, okay, now about these Benin bronzes, we went through three or four steps, and it was this project.
Okay.
And so at that time, at the time I applied to do research, there'd been a recent coup in Benin, and so I couldn't do it there, but I switched the grant to do it in Togo. Mm-hmm. And it did much the same thing. In this case, I lived in the community in one of the local houses. And the first thing was learning the language, because very few people spoke French. And then just began participant observation, interviewing, but looking and walking and seeing what was there and engaging it. And I actually took prodigious notes. I took as many photographs as I could. And then leaving, I remember riding in the car and down to the coast and actually mapping out the whole of the dissertation, which is pretty much what the book was, and realized that it's all about the human. It's all about the way we configure space and place around our own identities and anatomy. And sort of in relationship to this, I was invited to write an essay on ritual for one of these University of Chicago publications in the field. And one of the things I often tell my graduate students when they come back from the field, and even before, is, what was the most shocking thing that happened to you? What really stunned you? Because I find those things are often the entry point into something really significant. And in the context of this essay, and it's written about in the book, what shocked me the most was, I remember it was in the dry season, so in the winter, and a lot of people, most everybody was out in the fields and working. And I was going around taking photographs of each house and interviewing who I could about who were the builders and what they knew about it. And I remember arriving at a house and my research assistant, and I try to work really carefully with research assistants, you're kind of teaching them methodologies as well, walked right into the house and there was nobody there. And I just said, whoa, what are you doing? I mean, I would never do that. Yeah. Superimposing my own viewpoint.
Right.
And he came back and, you know, I was just pretty stunned. And he said, no, that's what we do. We have to say hello to the house.
Yeah.
Putting your head into the, what is metaphorically the mouth of the door and greet the door. And, you know, very soon afterwards, then I realized, oh my goodness, each of the key parts of the house has an anatomical reference.
Wow.
And so that's how that began.
That's so amazing. I was, you know, it seemed like so these houses that, as you've mentioned, virtually every aspect of them has a symbolic and a social function and relating to birth, to death, to the body, kind of everything about life. And I was thinking, this is kind of like the opposite of just functionalism, where you just have to kind of stay dry and have enough square feet and so forth. And could you just tell us a little bit more about kind of what these houses are like and what the symbolism is and how, I mean, I know it's a whole book, but just briefly, if you could say something.
Yeah, exactly. And let me just begin that by saying, if I had a critique of architectural history, it is that we have removed the occupants. We have removed the body, the belly, the heart of every building is. It's us sitting in this room. It's us experiencing the architecture. And if there's a book that I would love to see, it's of people who live in Frank Lloyd Wright houses. You're transformed by that experience, apparently. And some love it and some hate it. And I think that that is what I tried to do, and I think very few others have really done, is to marry the people within the house with the structure itself, not only as its creators, but also as its occupants. So the houses are two-story. Imagine a fortress. Historically, many of them were built on the hillsides. And what that meant is you've got the sloping of the hill. And so the facade of the building, they all face west. So that, and they all have a central door, so the sun comes directly into the portal, and particularly at the time of the winter solstice, so December 21st, it is bathed inside. So these are also calendrical devices in a way. And the ground floor, which whether it's flat or whether it's sloping, is where one would put the cattle, where one would put the chickens have their space, those animals. And this is the area where the men of the house will sleep on a raised bed. And then there's a small carved wood staircase that one goes up through an intermediary zone that is the kitchen, and then a back intermediary zone which has a drainage spout to the back, and that's where the bathing area, and then up onto the main terrace area, and off of that are the various bedrooms, generally circular. So it's a circular structure. And on the terrace area, one has one's evening meal. One will place some of the harvested grains for drying initially. The granaries are there at the very front. The house is divided rather neatly, male and female. As you're facing out of the door toward the west, the male granary is on the left and the female granary is on the right. They cultivate different crops. And of course, there's a lot of nuance in this, but the house is also a religious edifice, you know, dedicated to key gods. And you can actually read, the structure is very much the same.
Yeah.
It can be larger or smaller, depending on the need. And they have master architects who come in and actually do the design and cut through the entrance around the time of the winter solstice so that you can see the sunrise coming up as they're cutting through that earth. But you can read the facades on all of the various shrines and deities within the history of the family, and that kind of reading of the pathways of the gods and the identity of the family members is part of what becomes really wonderful. And then when somebody dies, you dress the house with a cloth, and it becomes a key part of that ceremony too.
That's you know, just that sense of the house, as you've described, being so integrated with life and family. I mean, it's just, I have to say, I'm thinking about like McMansions and so forth, and thinking how completely different it is. But at any rate, I also wanted to ask you about your book, African Vodun. And I had this thought that probably many Americans are aware of how the slave trade existed in the Western Hemisphere, and for that matter, Vodun in Haiti and so forth, but might not be aware that these were significant within Africa as well, and the kingdom of Dahomey. I wondered if you could just tell us a little about the kind of social world in which some of these Bacio figures were made and kind of that environment.
Right. So this was a book that grew out, again, of Peace Corps. I was living in a Yoruba town that had been conquered by the Dahomeans, and they had left it just effaced. They'd right. been terribly destructive in the course of the slave wars. And yet they themselves are the creators of one of the most amazing corpuses of art anywhere. So to go to the Romans, for example, being heinous toward other populations doesn't mean that you right. are not creative. Indeed, sometimes that kind of danger and horror gets re-engaged in very creative and art-rich ways.
Yeah.
And most people have focused on the royal arts of Dahomey, which are some of the most striking works anywhere. It's unique in Africa and in some ways in the world, in that when I know one of these works is real, it's because I've never seen anything like it before. I mean, each is such a creative, unique object, assemblages of the most complex nature. And I had really wanted to write a book on the royal arts, because that was in part what I was looking at, because they're so stunning. And I decided, it was a sabbatical year, and I was at another research institute, and I said, okay, let me get off an article on the Bocio, and then I'll get into the real meat. And, I also believe that it's important for a scholar to let these projects really take over one's life.
Yeah.
And they kind of decide what they're going to do and when they're going to be finished. And this just became a book. And it turned things on its head insofar as nobody had ever looked at these, either as art objects or as forms of cultural and political engagement. And one of the things that happened in Dahomey, as in Mexico with the Aztecs, is that in the case of Dahomey, when the French came in at the end of the 19th century, frankly, most people were elated. Not because of the arrival of the French, but just because the horrors of the slave trade, which had continued on into the end of the 19th century, even after it had been banned, was absolutely devastating. The troops would go out in harvest time, October, November, and that's when they would do all the destruction. And taking away the young people in the community, the older people, if they still survived, what would they live on? It was absolutely destructive. And so these are objects that is not the only thing, but the idea behind them goes deep into the roots of Vodun, which of course also became important in Haiti and their revolution, etc., have to do with a kind of philosophy of life, of sitting, taking in the sort of calmness of the spring, and thinking about what one can do in response. And these objects are kind of surrogates, are objects that are supposed to foil harm, whatever it may be in one form or another, coming in to raise havoc with members of that family. And all kinds of things are packed on it.
Yeah.
And I will here admit to academic plagiarism. I finally got the book off while I was at another research institute, and the first was the Institute for Advanced Study, and the second was the Getty. And they had a scholar's trolley with all the books that people were reading, and I would go early just to see what everybody's reading. And I picked up Joseph Kerner's book, and the beginning of, I think it was on the portrait of Christ. And I began reading it, and I said, oh my God, that's such stunning writing. I love the way he just unpacked that painting in the very first paragraph. And so I said, let me see if I can unpack one of these. I'll take the most complex and unpack it and try to describe it that way, which then led me into a whole way of reframing each of the chapters around it. So it's not really plagiarism. It's kind of in the Chinese sense of honoring somebody who's a great author and writer and thinker by using a trope that they had used.
Wow. I also wanted to ask you, so your lecture tonight and then the forthcoming book, you discuss Picasso and African art. And I was thinking, you know, in the kind of present day cultural politics, I can imagine someone saying something like, well, so Picasso was engaging in cultural appropriation. Picasso sort of took over in, you know, these ideas from African art, and that's basically what it's all about. I'm curious how you would comment on kind of that view of what Picasso is doing. Is that sort of what he's doing more or less?
No.
Or, no, he's not. Okay. So you'd say
and,
no.
And that's in part what I'm engaging
right.
with on this. It's complicated because I think for the last 20 years, 15 years, this is how he's been addressed within the post-structural theoretical community as largely questions of appropriation and colonialism, et cetera. I'm
right.
not saying that's not in play,
right.
but I'm saying that's a very small part of the richness of what is happening. And here, let me just go back to the beginning of this particular project. I was at the tail end of the Ife book and decided to go to the library to read that one of the early explorers who'd gone to Ife was a German traveler named Leo Frobenius. And I said, well, let me just take a look at a book that I had read in graduate school in German, Die Masken in Geheimbunde. I'm sure I won't find anything, but let me just check, right?
Yeah.
And so I went in and opened it up, and I had read it before his studies for Les Demoiselles had been published. And I opened up this book and I said, oh my God, that's the source for Les Demoiselles. Those are the sources for those African masks. And nobody had ever thought that Picasso was using books. And over the course of the next 3, 4, 5 years, I found 5 books that he was using. And they came through serendipity like that. That was the first one. The second one was a book I'm writing on Dahomey Amazon's Women Warriors, and I'd ordered a book from the medical school library and opened it up, and I said, my goodness, here's another one. And I found another. I was lecturing at the Collège de France, and a medieval scholar had put up another image. And so that's how that book began. I had no intention of doing this at all, but I had arrived to give a series of lectures in Paris. I was sleep deprived. I could, you know, and I finally give up on that. It's either going to work and I'm going to change my internal clock or not. So I arrived. I'd just gotten off the Ife book and I said, do whatever you want. You want to write fiction? Fine. You want to do nothing? Fine.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm curious. Let me just see the Picasso. And so I wrote the first 2 chapters doing that work. And what I would say to your question is that through these books, it gives a whole new meaning to the painting. It is not a bordello in the French sense, in the sense that we've used the word. It's,
right.
it's in the sense of the French word bordel, le bordel, which means a complex situation. It's a mess of things. And he is bringing together the historic mothers of each of the key races as he's
wow.
seeing them in the world. It's about sex, certainly, but it's about sex and heritage of motherhood and doing each in the style.
Wow.
Art style of the woman that are being depicted. And what he did that was so revolutionary, and this can go back a bit to Benjamin, is that even putting African women in conjunction with, in close proximity to Caucasian women, to European women, as were done in these books, even in the same painting, to put African women in the same large space, it's a very cramped space, but
right.
it's a large canvas.
Right.
It's revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And what he insisted was that African art is art. So yes, he's, and unlike so many others, he's not just taking African art. He used it almost as a studio, almost as if he had apprenticed himself to these artists through these books so that he really began to understand the structure of African art. And his insistence that it was art really was revolutionary. And the Museum of Modern Art, as you know, in the 1930s, was featuring African art alongside the great
yeah.
monuments of what becomes modern art. And I think one of the really hard things about the 20th century and about art history more generally is the insistence over time that no, Africa could not be the source for modern art. It could not be the source for 20th century European art. And so Africa's been written out of it.
Yeah.
You see almost no Africa in Leo Steinberg's volume. I mean, yeah, one of the things you'll see tonight is the African figures were African all along.
Yeah.
He did not efface them.
Yeah.
We have photographic evidence.
Yeah.
And for him, Africa was part of the humanity, the complexity. What colonialism did, mm-hmm. and yes, there was a lot of really horrendous stuff, and there still is, but it brought communities around the world together, as did photography, as did travel.
Yeah.
And it's that co-joining of these arts. And for him, primitive art was medieval art. I mean, he went to the Trocadero to see medieval French casts, not to see the African works. And that was part of this mix as well, of really reconfiguring the whole landscape of art history.
When you also wrote an op-ed piece when the Harvard Art Museums reopened after a renovation, and you expressed some disappointment about the kind of the overall situation of African art there at Harvard. I wondered if you could talk a little about kind of the institutional situation of African art, and has it changed in the time that you've been there?
Wow, you've hit on the key points. I have worked my whole career at Harvard to try to bring African art into the art museum. I moved from Columbia to Harvard with the idea that would be happening. There was a major gift that had been promised twice of African art, in this case African and Oceanic art, and I was asked to curate the first exhibit of it, and my understanding was that it would come to Harvard. And in the end, it did not. In the end, Harvard did not accept it, along with a fair amount of money to support a curatorship, and I went to the MFA Boston, and I worked for many years afterwards to try to make this happen. And I'm not the first. In 1968, Alfred Barr had actually gone to the corporation to ask them to do it. It was the year of the race riots, and Abby Rockefeller had given a Benin bronze head. Talk about patina. Bronze portrait head, Benin and Abby Rockefeller. And still it did not happen. Huh. And I had worked very hard. I went to meetings after meetings after meetings and trying to get it into the renovated art museum. And it did not happen. And I was invited to give a lecture at Yale just before then. And it was a true honor for me. It was the Distinguished Art History Lecture. And as an Africanist, and particularly because Yale has such a brilliant Africanist in the name of Bob Thompson, I was hugely honored and moving, right?
Yeah.
And going into the African art galleries there, which are stunning, just stunning. I mean, thank goodness for Yale for putting the space and the money, and for Susan Vogel, who helped to make it happen, and for the curators there. And I had tears.
Yeah.
I have tears now. Right?
Yeah.
And I came back to Harvard and I just said, I quit.
Yeah.
I can't fight this battle anymore.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that op-ed. It's titled Art Matters.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, not in my lifetime will this happen,
mm-hmm.
but it will happen.
Yeah.
But I'm no longer going to engage in it.
Yeah.
And shortly after, they hired a new director, Arthur Tadeci, who's now at Harvard. And we may be about to see the first purchase of African art. And I'm co-curating an exhibition there with a former student called Clay. And I'm hopeful, but important old institutions, it's hard to change. And in this case, it was because it goes to the colonial questions of African art was brought into Harvard as a kind of Africa is part of anthropology. It's part of the colonial agenda. And so it should only be viewed in that anthropology context, but it's not on view. Oh, there's pre-Columbian and Native American. And so I feel it's really important at great institutes of learning and smaller institutes and public and private that Africa is part of the mix, because art is what we mean by culture. And having African artworks at Harvard, at UT Dallas, in all of these wonderful museums is central. Even if it's one work, it says something.
This is the Athenaeum Review, and our guest today is Suzanne Preston-Blier. Her visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.